I have often wondered how scientists could accept the general theory of evolution as a viable explanation for the physical world, for the physical or natural world around us. Many of them are very intelligent individuals, well-educated individuals, at least in man's wisdom, and in many cases also quite familiar with the physical world. They've witnessed and studied the design evident in the creation around us. And yet, for some almost unfathomable reason, they have decided to believe in a godless theory that defies even the natural laws that they themselves recognize. And I have to be honest with you, that doesn't make sense to me. I wonder how people can do that. Well, of course, I think there are probably a number of different reasons that people do that, and I won't even pretend to be able to understand or to determine those reasons. I'd like to give people the benefit of the doubt. But I also believe that perhaps the Apostle Paul suggested at least one common cause in his letters to the Romans and the Ephesians as he describes some individuals in those epistles. This evening we're going to be looking at two passages primarily. One of those passages is Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through the end of the chapter, and Daniel read part of that reading for us just a few moments ago. The other reading, and the one to which I would encourage you to turn, we'll actually spend most of our time in Romans 1, but before we do that, return to that passage, we're going to spend a little bit of time in the book of Ephesians as well. In Ephesians, the fourth chapter, beginning in verse 17. I've chosen those two passages because I believe both of those passages are talking about the same group of people. And so this evening, we want to talk in the very beginning of our study about who those people were. In Ephesians, the fourth chapter, beginning in verse 17, we read as follows, reading from the English Standard Version. Now this I say and testify in the Lord, that you must no longer walk as the Gentiles do in the futility of their minds. They are darkened in their understanding, alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to their hardness of heart. They have become callous and have given themselves up to sensuality, greedy to practice every kind of impurity. But that is not the way you learned Christ. Assuming that you have heard about Him and were taught in Him, as the truth is in Jesus, to put off your old self, which belongs to your former manner of life and is corrupt through deceitful desires, and to be renewed in the spirit of your minds, and to put on the new self, created after the likeness of God in true righteousness and holiness. Beginning in verse 25, the Apostle Paul starts with the word therefore, and he connects the next few verses through the end of the chapter to this business of putting off the old man and putting on the new man. And he explains how the new man behaves. We've studied this passage fairly recently in the adult class, so I'll not belabor the point. I'm interested primarily in verses 17 through 24 because those verses describe a group of people who seem to be described in much the same way as that group of people in Romans, the first chapter, beginning in verse 18 and following. And so in this passage, I think Paul clearly in Ephesians 4 indicates that he's talking about Gentiles. In fact, in verse 17, he says to his readers that they must no longer walk as the Gentiles do in the futility of their minds. And so he indicates that they had walked as the Gentiles had done in the past. Verse 22, to put off your old self, which belongs to your former manner of life and is corrupt through deceitful desires. There are some other indications in the book of Ephesians in particular that Paul was writing about Gentiles. Verse 11 of chapter 2, therefore remember that at one time you Gentiles in the flesh, called the uncircumcision by what is called the circumcision, which is made in the flesh by hands. In this passage, Paul identifies his readers as Gentiles. There may have been some Jews as well in the church that's addressed in this epistle, but it seems very clear that he's writing to Gentiles, and they had lived like the Gentiles in the past. In Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 1, again, he says, "For this reason I, Paul, a prisoner for Christ Jesus on behalf of you Gentiles," speaking of his readers, the Ephesians. In the book of Romans, and you may wish to turn there now, in the book of Romans, it's not as clear who he's speaking to in the first chapter, but I believe chapter 2 helps us out a little bit. You may have noticed as you've read through chapter 1 from time to time that beginning in verse 18, Paul uses the personal pronoun they or them, the third person plural pronoun. They did such and such. They did not like to retain God in their knowledge, New King James Version. But when you move to chapter 2, the pronoun changes. And he says in chapter 2, beginning in verse 1, "Therefore, you have no excuse." He goes to the second person, plural, "Therefore, you have no excuse, O man, every one of you who judges. For in passing judgment on another, you condemn yourself, because you, the judge, practice the very same things. We know that the judgment of God rightly falls on those who practice such things." So there's those and you. "Do you suppose, O man, you who judge those who practice such things, and yet do them yourself, that you will escape the judgment of God?" What I want you to see from the first three verses of chapter 2 is that Paul is talking about two different groups of people, it seems. In the first chapter, he talks about they and them, and in chapter 2, he talks about you. And then as we move a little bit farther down in chapter 2, he then addresses, in this you group, Jews. He says, "But if you call yourself a Jew and rely on the law and boast in God," and then he continues to talk to them about their privileges and how they have abused their blessings given to them by God. But I want you to see that just like in Ephesians 4, where it's very clear that Paul's talking about Gentiles and their conduct, in Romans 1, Paul seems to be talking about Gentiles, even as he is distinguishing them from the group that he talks about in chapter 2, who are the Jews. Now, having said that, what we have done is we've just identified who the group of people are, but we want to spend a little bit of time describing them in some other ways. For instance, this passage really begins in verse 18. I know verse 18 is connected to verses 16 and 17 in the sense that Paul has talked about the just living by faith and how righteousness is by faith for faith or to faith. But then in verse 18, in contrast, he says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For His invisible attributes, namely His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse." And so whoever this group is, and I believe it's the Gentiles, Paul says they are without excuse because God has given them information about Himself. Now, Paul also notes that that information was given to them in the things that have been made. And so I believe Paul's clearly talking about the natural revelation. That is creation and what can be learned about God from creation. Paul says in verse 20, rather, His invisible attributes. I really like the New King James Version translation here. It says His invisible attributes are clearly seen. And so there's a play on that which cannot be seen because it's invisible, and yet as the ESV translates, can be perceived by the things that have been made in the creation. All Paul is saying is that when you look at the creation, you can understand some things about God. Now, I don't believe Paul is saying that the Gentiles could understand, for instance, what they needed to do in order to please God or to be saved. But they could understand some things. They could understand His eternal power. Who can look at the creation on a clear night and see all the stars? And assuming that it was created and not by chance, who cannot imagine or struggle to imagine the power that would be necessary to create the universe that we live in? Who could see the design, the way that nature works piece by piece together, and not understand the wisdom of God, His divine nature in that respect? And Paul says, God revealed these things to the Gentiles, and as a result, they are without excuse. They're inexcusable for their conduct, because he's going to go on to say what they ended up, the path they ended up taking, but he basically says they knew God as much as was possible through natural revelation. But what was their response? Well, Paul intimates what their response should have been in verses 21 and 22 of this chapter. He says, for although they knew God, obviously from the standpoint of what they could learn from natural revelation, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks to Him. But they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools. Paul says they should have honored Him, the Creator, as God. And they should have been thankful to Him. I believe the concept of being thankful implies the understanding that one is dependent upon God. Is that not essentially what we're doing when we give thanks for our blessings? We're being reminded, we are acknowledging that we have received from God the things that we need. And Paul says they should have understood that they needed God, depended on God, but they didn't. They didn't honor Him as God. They didn't give thanks to Him. You know, I find it interesting that one of the things that Paul emphasizes as a responsibility to those who understand that there is a God and understand something about His power and His divine nature is that they ought to be thankful. I would suggest to you that a lot of sin begins right there with unthankfulness. And so what they should have done, they actually did not. In fact, he says down in verse 28, in the beginning of that verse, and since they did not see fit to acknowledge God. The New King James Version uses a little different expression that I think maybe is more vivid, and that is that they did not like to retain God in their knowledge. It's not so much that they just were indifferent to God. They just didn't acknowledge Him. They kind of ignored Him. They didn't want to retain God in their knowledge. In fact, go back, if you will, to the beginning of this section, to verse 18. Verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness, New King James Version, in unrighteousness, suppress the truth. Today, there are lots of people who do not believe in God. Scientists who spend their lives delving into the secrets and the intricacies of the world around us. And they are not content simply to say, well, I believe it all happened by time and chance. But they wish to suppress the truth that there is a Creator. Do you see that this is not just benign complacency, but that it is in fact a deliberate effort to suppress what creation says about the origin of our world, that it's created and didn't come about as a matter of time and chance. And so they didn't like to retain God in their knowledge. They suppressed the truth. And so instead, of honoring him and giving thanks, they became futile in their thinking. And he says, their foolish hearts were darkened. They claimed to be wise, but became fools. There's some interesting words here. The word futile there in verse 21 means vain. In fact, it's probably translated that way in some translations, or useless. They became vain or useless in their thinking. Sometimes I get amused. Obviously, I'm not a scientist, and so I don't have the educational background to evaluate some of the statements that scientists, evolutionary scientists, make without the help of others. But I do get amused sometimes at some of the things that they say and some of the twists that they take in order to try to explain something that is so obvious by something that really doesn't make any sense. And he says, their foolish hearts were darkened. The word foolish here is a word that means without understanding. In fact, I believe the New American Standard Version translates it senseless. And their senseless hearts were darkened. I believe that phrase means that their spiritual perception was blunted. They claimed to be wise but became fools. The word that's translated fool there is related to our English word, moron. It is a cognate, the Greek word is, of the Greek word from which we get our English word, moron. Now, I'm not being nasty or anything, but that's the truth of the matter. That's the derivation of the word. And I want to share something with you that's interesting. That same word is used over in Matthew, the 5th chapter, in the Sermon on the Mount as well. It's used in verse 13. I'm going to read the verse to you. It won't show up on the screen here, but here's the verse. This is the ESV version. Matthew 5:13. Jesus says, "You are the salt of the earth. But if salt has lost its taste," that's the word that we're talking about. You know, I've noticed that when you mothers try to take the children out so that they can't hear the sermon, they just cry. And I understand. I understand. "You are the salt of the earth," Jesus said. "But if salt has lost its taste," that expression is translated from the same verb that is translated "became fools." We're dealing with verbs here. And the idea in Matthew 5:13 is this salt has basically become useless. As Jesus says, it's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. It has become tasteless. It's empty, having nothing useful. Think about that. Claiming to be wise, they became empty of wisdom. They became useless, like salt that has lost its taste. And Jesus says, it's not good for anything except to throw out and people walk on it. Interesting words, but that's the path that they took. When they didn't want to acknowledge God, when they rejected God, suppressed the truth about God, then this is the way they go. They turned away from the true God to serve idols. I want you to notice some of the contrast that Paul draws here. I think at least three times he talks about idolatry in this group of people. We're talking about the Gentiles here primarily. Verse 23, "They exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things." Did you see the contrast? The immortal God, the God who never perishes or dies, and they chose to worship those things, men, birds, animals, even creeping things, that are mortal, that are perishable. He says in verse 25, "Because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie." And they worshipped and served the creature rather than the creator. Now, I don't know, in creature there, some commentators, there in verse 25, some commentators look at that as the thing created, meaning the idol that a man would make, and then he bows down to it and worships it. I'm not sure that's the point at all. It may simply be that men were worshiping those things that God made, beasts, creeping things, even man himself, instead of the Creator. See the contrast? Lie versus the truth, serving the creature rather than the Creator. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, they chose to serve instead false idols who could do nothing. In the prophets, in such passages as Isaiah 44, in Jeremiah 2, in Jeremiah 10, and Psalm 106, the prophets talk about the foolishness, the silliness of a man who will worship something that he has made with his own hands. He is, by definition, superior to that which he worships, instead of worshiping the God who, in fact, made him, that is, man himself. But Paul continues to suggest that not only did they turn to idolatry, but they turned to all manner of unrighteousness. In verse 24, in the lusts of their hearts, God gave them up to, in the lusts of their hearts, to impurity or uncleanness, as the New King James Version says, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves. He calls it dishonorable passions or vile passions, New King James Version, verse 26. And he talks about men in verse 27 committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty for their error. Verse 28, God gave them up to a debased mind or a perverted mind. I want you to notice something in verse 29. It's not up on the screen there, but I'm going to read beginning in verse 28, Romans 1, 28 and 29. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do whatever ought not to be done. They were filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. They're gossips, and he continues with this list of sin. List of sins. You know what's interesting about verse 29? Paul is trying to emphasize that their lives are full of this kind of behavior. They're filled with all kinds of unrighteousness. They're full of these sins, not the occasional thing. You ever wondered how the world could ever have gotten into the state where the Bible could describe mankind as every thought and intent of the heart of man was always evil? Evil continually. Have you ever wondered how man could ever get to that point? Think about that expression. That men were just given over to wickedness and violence. The earth was filled with violence. Those phrases are taken from Genesis 6 in the time of Noah. And for that, God decided that he would destroy the earth. That is, he would destroy all living creatures except those on the ark with Noah. This is how that happens. Have you noticed that it seems like our society is less and less concerned with lawfulness and holiness? That there seems to be more violence in our society? Less respect for God? We're following the same path. And why not? What did they start with? They decided to reject God. They set up other things to worship. And then they turned to whatever, we sometimes say floated their boat. I'm not sure that's a good expression that will convey it. They turned to whatever passions satisfied them. Whatever debased, perverted things, shameless things, vile passions. And that's what we're seeing in our society now. And you know where it started? It started with individuals teaching young people that there is no God. And when people believe that, they'll find something else or someone else to worship. And what they worship is man himself, humanism. I want you to listen to some statements by R.L. Whiteside. These are taken from his commentary on Romans as he comments on this very same passage in Romans 1. He says, when men are not held in restraint by a feeling of personal responsibility to God, nor by associating with those who do honor God, their passions become the controlling force in their lives. They plunge into all sorts of immoralities, and they dishonor their bodies among themselves. It's a fair description, not just of those in Romans 1, but of people in our time, in our society. When a people cease to respect God, they will not long respect their own bodies. We're in a spiritual battle right now to affirm the sanctity of marriage, that it is between a man and a woman. And every day, it seems, something comes across the internet, or you see it in the news or whatever, in which there's a push being made to cause people to have to accept homosexuality. That's where it's going. And this is why it's happened. Last comment. If a man does not regard God nor the honor of his own body, it's not likely that he'll have much regard for his fellow man. Let's read the rest of the list. Beginning in verse 29, they were filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice. They're full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Though they know God's righteous decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them but give approval to those who practice them. Look at how many of those words talk about the relationship of man with fellow man. And Whiteside says, when you stop listening and respecting God, then you're not going to probably have much respect for those that God has created alongside of you. Well, the last thing I want to look at here is God's response to all of this. It's interesting that three times in this section, you see the phrase in verses 24, 26, and 28, God gave them up. And what I want you to see is that in each case, that expression is related not to immorality. What he gave them up to was all of this moral turpitude. But what's connected to that is their idolatry. Look at verse 23. That's the verse that talks about they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for mortal man, images of mortal man. Then the very next verse, therefore God gave them up. Verse 25, they exchanged the truth about God for a lie, worshiped, served the creature rather than the creator. Verse 26, for this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, they worshiped these idols, God gave them up to a debased mind. I believe that what that phrase says, God gave them up, is that at some point, God stopped trying to restrain these individuals. I believe that's probably what happened in the time of Noah, when Noah was informed that God was not going to strive with man indefinitely. There was a period of time, and then there would be this worldwide flood. God allowed these people who were determined not to accept Him, but to reject Him and to worship false gods, He allowed them to follow their chosen path of sins, unhindered by any efforts to reclaim them. You know, God sent prophets to His own people again and again, calling them to repentance when they would stray from His covenant, from His commandments. But with this group, God said, enough is enough. I'm going to let them receive the penalty that is due their sins. And so even as they rejected God, verse 28, He rejected or abandoned them. He abandoned them to the consequence of their sins. Not to be a prophet of doom, but do you suppose God will abandon this nation to its sins, to the consequence of its sins? If we follow the same path that these people followed, will God not do the same thing for us that He did for them? Give them up? to the consequences of their sins. Let them be unrestrained, and they'll be punished. Paul goes on to list some of the sins common to these morally bankrupt people. But even though he said he gave them up, it's interesting. Remember how this section started? Verse 18, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men." God gave them up. He stopped trying to restrain them. But that doesn't mean they're not going to be punished. There's another passage that's very similar to these passages in 1 Peter chapter 4. Once again, it deals with the conduct of Gentiles. And Peter writes, "For the time that is past suffices for doing what the Gentiles want to do, living in sensuality, passions, drunkenness, orgies, drinking parties, and lawless idolatry." Does that sound like Romans 1? It does to me. "With respect to this, they are surprised when you," that is Christians, "do not join them in the same flood of debauchery, and they malign you, but they will give account to him who's ready to judge the living and the dead." And so at the same time that it seems like our society is running the same path as these people of Romans 1, we need to remember God's still in control, and God will punish all unrighteousness, all wickedness. In Ephesians, let's go back to Ephesians, the fourth chapter. Actually, I'm going to put both of these passages up on the screen if you want to just see them there. It's interesting that Paul talks about the walk of the Ephesians, the way that they needed to conduct themselves or behave. And in the beginning of Ephesians 4, he says, "I therefore, a prisoner for the Lord, urge you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you have been called." How is that? "With all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another in love, eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace." Contrast verse 3 or 2 and 3 with all of those sins that we read about in Romans 1. All of the malice and the covetousness and the violence, murder, sexual sins. That's the walk that Christians ought to follow. In fact, I believe there's a contrast between that walk and the one that Paul describes in Ephesians 4:17 that we read. "Now this I say and testify in the Lord, that you must no longer walk as the Gentiles do in the futility of their minds." And so Paul says, here are two different walks. That's the way you used to walk. Just like many of us walked in the past. Now we may not have been involved in all of the sensuality of these Gentiles or in all of the idolatry of these Gentiles. Certainly not idolatry in the sense of images. But the fact of the matter is, we all walk that road. The road of unrighteousness. And Paul says, that's where you were before. But now what I'm urging you to do is to walk in a manner that is worthy of the calling with which you have been called. I think as Americans become more comfortable with the general theory of evolution, there's no God. It should be no surprise to us that we're now fighting all manner of unrighteousness in society, and especially homosexuality. Remember the path that these people trod in Romans chapter 1. So what should we do about that? Well, obviously we need to try to follow the proper walk. But Paul observed in 2 Corinthians, the 10th chapter, that there's a warfare going on. And he noted that the weapons of his warfare were not carnal in their nature. Paul wasn't talking about physical weapons in the sense of helicopters and tanks and stinger missiles and stuff like that. He was talking about weapons like gossip and malice and lying and those sorts of things. And what he said is that we need to, in chapter 10 and verse 5 of 2 Corinthians, destroy arguments and every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God, and take every thought captive to obey Christ. We're in a battle for men's minds. We need to be trying to convince them that this is foolishness, these theories that there is no God, and that we came about as a result of time and chance. Paul mentions in Ephesians 4 and verses 1 through 3, particularly in verse 1, he says, "Walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you have been called." We have been called, Paul himself also indicated, by the gospel of Jesus Christ, to an inheritance, Peter wrote, that is imperishable, undefiled, and unfading, that is reserved in heaven for us. Think about that. Imperishable. This morning we made the observation that there's hardly anything in this world that doesn't change, and in many cases deteriorate, weaken, rust. But what's waiting for you and waiting for me as Christians is an inheritance that will never perish. He says that it's undefiled. There's no stain on it. It's not mostly good. It is entirely good. And it is unfading. I bought Debbie some flowers. She likes carnations. And I thought it was kind of interesting when I first bought the carnations, they really didn't smell all that well. I mean, they didn't have a lot of scent. They didn't have a sweet scent. But as they aged a little bit, the scent became stronger. But you know, they reach a point where they start to deteriorate, and pretty soon they have no scent again. Your inheritance in heaven will never be like that. Where at some point you just get tired of it. You've had enough. It's lost its shine for you, its beauty. It'll be unfading. That's hard to imagine, because it's outside of our experience with almost everything in this life. In fact, everything in this life. Everything has a tendency to fade. But not our inheritance. Those are wonderful thoughts. And the question is, do you have that inheritance waiting for you? If you're not a Christian, you need to lay hold of the hope that God has set before us. The hope of eternal life. Fellowship with God in this inheritance that is reserved for us in heaven. If we can assist you in becoming a Christian this evening and obeying the gospel as you see the steps on the screen, then we certainly want to do so, and we encourage you as we stand and sing this evening.